Omaha Public Radio presents another program from Film Streams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema on Noon Forum. On today's program, a Film Streams double feature. On the first half, we'll hear a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2009 Canadian documentary film Real Engine, directed by Cree filmmaker Neil Diamond. The event was co-sponsored by the Native American Studies Program at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and by Native American Public Telecommunications Incorporated, presented in partnership with the 4th Biennial Vision Maker Film Festival, which took place the first week of October at the Mary Reepma Ross Media Arts Center and the Sheldon Art Museum in Lincoln, Nebraska. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, September 20th, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of Film Streams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Released in 2009 and the recipient of a Peabody Award, Real Engine takes an entertaining and insightful look at the Hollywood Indian, exploring the portrayal of North American Indians through the history of cinema. Traveling through the heartland of America, director Neil Diamond looks at how the myth of the Injun has influenced the world's understanding and misunderstanding of Indians. The film traces the evolution of cinema's depiction of North American Indians from the silent era to today, featuring candid interviews with directors, writers, actors, and activists such as Clint Eastwood, Jim Jarmusch, Robbie Robertson, Sasheen Littlefeather, John Trudell, and Russell Means. It also includes clips from hundreds of classic and recent films, including Stagecoach, Little Big Man, The Outlaw Josie Wales, One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and Atanarjuat, The Fast Runner. This special screening of Real Engine is part of Filmstream's community development program, which facilitates partnerships with other nonprofits and community groups on film-related events that speak to their missions and programming. The members of the panel will include Eduardo Zendejas, director of the Native American Studies Program at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and actor Gary Farmer, born in Oswegan, Ontario, Canada, into the Cayuga Nation and Wolf Clan. Here now to introduce the program is Eduardo Zendejas.
I'd like to introduce our special guest for the evening. You might have recognized him. There's a couple of shots of him in the movie. This is Gary Farmer. Veteran actor. There you go. Yeah, you can do that. I'd like to think he's a good friend of UNO, aren't you, Gary?
Yes, that's one of my favorite places.
Oh, good answer. Good answer. We like that. Gary is joining us from all the way from Santa Fe, heading on back home for a little visit, but stopped here to take a little bit of time and discuss a little bit about his experience and a little bit about what we've seen in this documentary. Well, I'd like to start by first sharing a couple of things. As I was watching this, I heard a lot of laughing, and sometimes I heard a lot of ooh. But I was thinking, we all live through that.
Yeah.
And you've had firsthand experience in working in the movies and being a part of that movie making process.
Yeah.
But one of the things I think I'd like to start off with in terms of a little story. I have to tell a story. Those students in my class know I have to tell a story. About a year ago, I was asked to speak at a grade school. It was fourth graders. It was just south of town here. I won't name the town. But I went, and there were supposed to be about 200 fourth graders. It's a fairly large school. And I go into the office, and I tell them, you know, I'm here for the Native American Day speaker. And so the office lady takes me to the gymnasium where all the fourth graders are going to be. And we get there, and there's maybe some kindergartners that are in the gym, and the PE teacher's there. And so she tells the PE teacher, you know, we need to clear these students out because we're going to have this speaker, Native American Day speaker. And so the PE teacher has to go outside to see if there's, you know, if there's, it rained and see if there's a safe place to take them. In the meantime, he told the office lady to watch the kids. And so I kind of sit down off to the side. And she tells the kids to line up against the wall, and she says, Now, we're going to have to move you because we've got a gentleman over here that's going to talk to our fourth graders about Native Americans, Indians. You know, the people that wear headbands and put feathers in their hair. And as soon as she said that, about, I don't know, 20, 35 little kindergartners start going, put their hands, and I just sat there stunned. And when I got up, I got all the fourth graders there, and I got up to speak, and I said, I know what I'm going to talk about today, and it's kind of a big word, but it's called stereotypes. Can you say stereotypes? So, and this is just a confirmation of that in terms of what we grew up with, you know, in the movies and it's still prevalent today. So I'd like to ask Gary, if he would, share some of his firsthand experiences in terms of the roles that you've played and maybe how they coincided with some of the things that we've talked about in terms of, you know, the noble, the savage, the spiritualist, and your thoughts about, you know, Hollywood and how you've perceived it over the years.
Well, my personal experience with Hollywood, I suppose, started with Powwow Highway in 1987, though I had done a fair amount of film acting prior to that. But if I was hired as a Native person, it was kind of a contemporary thing. Graham and I did a series in early 80s where we played two fishermen in a community. It's called something. I can't think of it. But, you know, we played real people. We actually shot in the real community. This is back in the early 80s. So Graham and I, Green, who played in Dances with Wolves and got nominated for Academy Award for that film, but lost to Joe Pesci in Goodfellas. But I think... Graham and I grew up together in the theater, so we did a lot of plays. When we started doing plays, the plays weren't written by Native people. They were written by non-Native people, and by the end of our time with the theater, all the plays were written by Native people. So we saw that transition as actors when the material wasn't written by us. And so I was much more aggressive in terms of my relationship with the writers and trying to do right by the people. And Graham always was tried to get along with everybody and just tried to do the right thing, where I was much more aggressive. So that was an interesting, and that kind of led to our eventual split as friends in the end, especially during that Academy Award time. We were in a play together, which I kind of left Hollywood to come back and do in Toronto. And we took a play from like a small 200-seat house to a large 1,500-seat house. And it was a Native written play called Dry Lips Ought to Move to Kapuskasing. And we reached the kind of pinnacle of Canadian theater in Toronto. And he was nominated for Academy Award, and we were both nominated for acting in this play. And Powwow Highway had just come out. So it was a really interesting period to see how, you know, the careers change and how Hollywood can affect your personal situation as far as an actor. If you have a hit film or nominated for Academy Award, that can have a huge impact on your career. But I think just choosing the material that we did, that we were offered, most of the time, you know, I couldn't afford to turn down anything that I ever got. So, but I always wore a wig. I used to have good hair, but I lost my hair when I was young. And so they it's always sad. Put a wig on me. I don't know. I never did an Indian film without a wig, probably till Skins, which I see there was 2002 with Chris Eyre. But Powwow Highway, Dead Man, Smoke Signals, you know, I always had to wear a wig. So, you know, I've dealt with the stereotypes. I remember I turned down an episode of Grace, Will and Grace or something, because they wanted me to wear a wig. And I said, well, why do I have to wear a wig? Can't I just be myself? You know, it's a, it was a spiritual.
You were the spiritualist.
The spiritualist. Okay. But I didn't do it in the end because I wouldn't wear the wig. So I fought not to wear wigs and stuff, but I've always had to wear wigs.
So, they were insistent upon you wearing the wig.
But I was never in these kinds of movies, right? I wasn't the svelte, skinny Indian that starved to death during the Trail of Tears. You know, I was the chubby contemporary Indian, so I never experienced a lot of what, you know, they speak of in the John Ford days, which... There's another great documentary by another, I don't even know what to call him, but Hopi filmmaker named Victor Masaisva. He did a film about that John Ford era, too, which was fascinating because, you know, in order for those horses to fall and all that, they used to put wires across and stuff, so they didn't know that. And they'd be charging along, and all of a sudden they would all fall. And they used to laugh because all the ones that wanted to be in the front got paid off bad, you know, because... got tripped up by wire by John Ford being an extra, you know, to make all those horses fall when they shot and stuff. So there was a lot of...
Speaking of horses, do you remember you were telling me the story once of I asked you a question. I said, Gary, how'd you miss out on that Dances with Wolves, you know, gravy chain? All those Indian actors, how come you weren't in? Do you remember what you said to me? Mind if I tell them?
Go for it.
He said... The directors told me I was too fat to be on a horse.
Yeah, I don't remember saying that.
I remember. I'm going to catch heat for that, but but he did say it. No. So speaking of your roles, what was one of your favorite roles to do?
Well, it had to do mostly because you saw this character, Jim Jarmusch. I don't know how many of your films. How many have seen... Atunarjiat, that Inuit film they spoke of in there. Oh, not that many. So we could screen that next and probably do well. You should take a look at that. But my favorite film, of course, was Dead Man, because I got to work with, it was, what's his name's last movie? I can't think of him now. Anyway, Johnny Depp, of course. And
Robert Mitchum's last movie.
Robert Mitchum's last film. And you're working with such an artist like Jim Jarmusch, who was at kind of the height of his film career, you know. That film won, you know, I want you to know Dead Man won the best foreign film from the European Academy Award. It was the first American film ever to win that, you know, which we had fun going to pick that award up, Johnny and I. All we did was look for the best Wiener Schnitzel in Berlin for 3 days. So that was the most exciting because we got to go to the Cannes Film Festival in France and I'll never forget the screening of Dead Man. It was 2 hours and 20 minutes then. And I was sitting next to Neil Young on one side and Johnny Depp on the other and Jim Jarmusch. And as the lights went down in the French cinema, it was 3,000 seats in the house, just all full. And you, from the darkness, just as the lights go down on the film, the final credits run, the lights go down. And from the third balcony, you can hear, "This is Jim." It was like one of Charlie's right into Jim's heart, you know. He was so brokenhearted that night, and so was I. It was a very hurtful thing. Just one comment can destroy a whole effort, you know. But anyway, we had a lot of fun with that film and to work with all those actors with all that production and I don't know how many people have seen. How many people have seen Dead Man, the film? Oh, yeah, quite a few. So there's still quite a few that haven't seen it. So they don't know what I'm talking about.
I always tell my students in class, I make them watch Smoke Signals. I was feeling pretty good about myself because when they start talking about Dancing with Wolves, I always tell my students, that's not an Indian movie. And so to hear it validated in here kind of made me feel good in terms of maybe they you know have a little more credibility now. But I make them watch, we get to watch Smoke Signals and you know, we talk about the modern, non-stereotypical Indian. And I always tell my my tribal member students, Native students, I've said, you really can't claim to be Native unless you can quote from smoke signals. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you remember when he first came and talked to us at UNO last year, you know, it was a question and answer period. And for those of you that, how many of you have seen smoke signals? I'll see a good number of them have.
Yeah.
And there's a scene of you when you're walking with Irene Bedard, Susie Song, mm-hmm. and you know your truck breaks down and you know, you're carrying groceries back, and then you ask her, "So what's the worst thing you've ever done?"
Right.
And then you know she makes up something. Oh, that's only about money. And you had done something worse. You know, and she talks about some other things. But we were having an answer question and answer period, and it was kind of a lull in the questioning. So I raised my hand and so I said, "Gary, what's the worst thing you've ever done?" Thinking that you know you'd I was quoting from smoke signals, but he was sitting there thinking about, "Man, what's the worst thing I've ever done?" He said, "I'll tell you later."
Yeah.
But it kind of brought home to me the fact that you've done so many movies, you probably, you know, smoke signals is probably just a blip on your radar screen.
Well, after a while, especially because what I think this film says mostly is, where's Indian cinema now, right? Where's it at now? Where are the filmmakers? How many Indian cinema makers are there in this room tonight? Please stand. You know, and that's what I think leads that there is some, you know. There are people now making stories, telling new stories, and because I've had to always work for, you know, once in a while you work for your own, but not too often because, you know, most of the productions are still not controlled by Natives unless they're truly independent and they're doing it with their family or something. But there's some success stories, even at that level, with Native American families training the young people and the youth are taking control of the storytelling for a whole community. And that's the beautiful thing. I remember when I used to work in Hollywood in the 80s, you had to go to Hollywood to survive as an actor if you wanted to work in film. And so, but now you don't because technology's changed, right? Technology's made it so that anyone can make a film now. And anyone, that means anybody in this room, can pick up a relatively inexpensive camera and take that. If you make a good story and you can shoot it, you can actually tell a film. So tell a story that needs telling, you know. And I always thought that we should decentralize Hollywood. And I think technology has allowed us to do that, to take stories into the small nevets of America where stories haven't been told for so long. So I think that's what I love mostly about this film is that it opens up the possibilities, okay? So you guys write the next chapter in a way because, you know, we kind of waded through a lot of... it was challenging, you know, trying to be someone that was being created by someone else for, you know, kind of economic reasons and yet you're there to kind of tell that story and take responsibility for it. It hasn't been an easy career for me. I've resisted, you know. I get in trouble all the time for the wrong reasons sometimes, and I may have learned too much from Marlon Brando, you know. But, you know, as an artist, I always felt, you know, especially in the making of Powwow Highway, you know, they wanted to take the Fort Robinson scene out. They wanted to take, you know, the tokens away. They wanted to not have me naked in the film, you know? Not that I wanted to be naked, but I thought that it gave...
At least you weren't running on ice, though, huh?
It gave the film something strength, you know, to tell that story. So, you know, you have to fight for those things and rather be than... I never felt that... and I don't have a successful Hollywood career, this may be why, but I just never... stood in line and was the cow. You know, I never wanted to be that. I wanted to be a thinking, compassionate, loving Indian person. And I think that's what Adam was kind of saying, that now's the opportunity where we can really take them inside now, you know, the audience. It's time to take them home and to tell them the real stories, you know, that haven't been told. And, One of the stories I find most fascinating is that whole relationship between Black America and Indian America. You know, that whole, the whole, we never even talk about slavery. There isn't even a museum of slavery, you know. Like, we don't even recognize some of that history that we've experienced and the genocide that really did happen on this continent, you know. And I know those aren't easy stories to swallow all the time, but I just thought there is that potential for the, you know, for us to take, because finally I think we are more accepted as human beings in cinema now than we were certainly when I started, you know. So I'd like to say that I'm passing the torch to those two young filmmakers up there, that it's hopefully it's their films we're watching in 10 years here, you know.
One of the things we did this afternoon was spoke to a group of students at South High School, and one of the projects that we're working on this entire year is to get our young people to start telling their own stories. And so frequently, from an academic standpoint, whenever we talk about history books or any other kind of books, you can borrow mine if you want. They're always, not always, but for the most part, written from a non-native perspective. And so one of the things that I thought was important was to get some of these young kids to start identifying their families and also to start writing their own stories from their perspective. And it was a great experience to see Gary encouraging these kids to do that. And I think that's what's going to lead us into the next, you know, the next era of filmmaking is, first, we have to start documenting and writing our stories.
Does anyone have any questions out there?
Gary, why have you not made a film?
You know, I have made several films, documentaries, short films. You know, I had a chance to reinvent myself, I guess, a few years ago, and I turned to music. Film, you know, music is more solitary. I can write on my own. I can create it and produce that on my own. Film, you need people. You need money. You got to chase money forever. No one chases money for me for anything. So I got to chase all my own money, and I tried it a few times, but it's too hard. It's too much work. If somebody came to me and said, Gary, we want you to make this film, I'm all over that. Or, Gary, we want you to direct this play. Or, Gary, help us teach these people how to do this, you know. So I do a lot of that, and I hope that, you know, my influence on young filmmakers, which I do a lot of work with youth, specifically about media making and expressing themselves in cinema. So, you know, something may come from that. But it's just, I'm getting almost too old. I prefer to write the song than to make the film right now.
What types of songs do you write?
You know, love songs, songs about our lives, songs about what I feel we're going to be confronted with, you know, in the future, and what are we going to do when it happens, and, you know, making people think. That's what I do tend to. But I also it's generally through the genre of kind of blues.
His blues band is Gary Farmer and the Troublemakers. Actually, we had them last year, and they went to the concert. We were scheduled to have them this summer, but flooding, rain kind of got washed
nuclear
out.
Nuclear disaster.
Yeah. So
we didn't talk about.
I'd like to have more of your thoughts about this documentary, particularly since the Neil Diamond makes a point of talking about women being erased from those early films, but then he seems to do his own a job of preventing or not including very many women as filmmakers or as actresses other than Sasheen. So any thoughts about that, and maybe some advice for women trying to get into film?
You know, I was trying to show a film we did, and I think it was the first film we ever did together with Graham Greene and a guy named Tom Jackson, who's another Canadian actor. Tantu Cardinal, who you all, of course, may know, Tantu, and Margot Kane, Shirley Chicha. We did it in 1977, and it was about Bill C-31, which is a Canadian term. Because in the old days, when one of our women on the res married a non-native, it could be an Indian from another tribe, she got kind of excommunicated from our people. And when a man married a non-native woman, she became an Indian by the Indian Affairs thing. So they changed that back in the 80s. I don't think it happened till this film we made was about prior to the actual change that the government made to bring. And then our community grew by about 30% when they kind of all came home. But, yeah, I never understood. I mean, that's generally, though, even in actors as actresses. I mean, how often do you see lead actresses having to play the whole, you know, the prostitute? Or they're never like, it's because I think, I'm not sure, but, you know, all cinema, all television is based on conflict. And so they always look for the obvious conflict very suddenly for the subtlety of what I find in a woman's character often. Even playwrights have a hard time writing women sometimes. But it's a condition of the overall movement. In terms of my experience, I just finished working with Casey Camp Hornick, who's from Oklahoma, actress, was in a great film by... See, are you supposed to be the film? What's it? Yeah, Sterling Hargill, thank you.
I can't hear you.
So it's Barking Water. You know, there's a beautiful... and also, I think that film's not based on necessarily the conflict, because I'm more interested in films based on peace, because that's how my people, you know, that's how they live, in peace. And so, I mean, that's about taking in... And I think there's potentially a whole Indian cinematic, in terms of approaching cinema. I think we have that ability with these two young Native women filmmakers and can begin to make changes to that, you know. And I think that's really important point, and thank you for bringing it up, because they've never gotten the recognition they deserve. And filmmakers like Shelley Nero, I don't know how many people have seen any of her work, or I can think of a couple other Indian filmmakers, even like Sheila Towsey, the work that she does with theater and how she's really worked so hard is really becomes unrecognized, yeah, even in this film, yeah.
Hi, my question is, I think one of the things that might drive some of the changes would be Indians as producers. And Gary, do you have any insight on that of any up-and-coming producers that are Native?
Well, the problem with that is you need to be producing for something. And what have we got? We don't have anything. Maybe one out of 50 filmmakers on point of view, maybe one is Native American. You got to have your own channel. And that's what we did in Canada. We started our own national television channel, just like CBC, CTV, City TV, is the Aboriginal People's Television Network. And I just finished doing a series for them, 9 episodes, 1 hour, dramatic. And it's produced and directed by Native American or Indians from Canada. They're Aboriginal people, they call themselves. So unless we got a channel, then we got nothing to do, right? So we need a channel. But that's a big thing, right? That's a big commitment. And here we have the Native American Public Telecommunications chair here. Shirley, is Shirley here today? Oh, Shirley, tell us the chances. What's the problem with us getting our own television channel for Native America in the United States?
Money. we're losing half of our children at high school. They don't graduate from high school. So then when you've only got 5 million Indians, and then of those, half of their children aren't graduating from high school, how many of them are not going to film school and learning how to be producers and directors? And so that's one of the issues that really troubles our industry is going to school, graduating, being engaged to go on to that next step.
So that's a whole different ball of wax, right? Yeah. And we just don't have access to CBS, NBC. We could. I tried to convince the Seminoles, okay, give me a creative team, you know, of actors and writers, and I'll create you an original drama that we can produce for $250,000, and then we can sell it to CBS or NBC, right? then we sell it to them, and then we buy they'll buy the series from us. That's otherwise we got to suit to their Hollywood beaten ways, and they have a system we don't fit into. It's like trying to fit a marble into a, you know, rectangle, right? So you don't fit that comfortably. So it's I think that's the solution is to, but you know, there's so many other things. We're basically, and I think that system would help because basically what we're fighting in the community here is trying to keep our kids alive, you know, to reach 18 and progress. But I can understand why they resist the system because it's not doesn't reflect their reality, right? So why would I wouldn't buy into education either if I was a young Indian person because it doesn't it's not who I am, you know, it's not reflecting me. Neither is television reflecting most of us, for that matter, because it's driven by economic reasons, not by human reasons. And even any public television we used to have is now gone. So, you know, we live in a fascist regime. What are we going to do, you know?
That's why I think it's important, the projects that we're trying to do in terms of our young youth and getting them to, one, know who they are. Two, they need to start telling their own stories from their perspective. And I think that's the overriding theme in terms of what we're looking for in the future is to overcome a lot of the stereotypes that have been developed over the years. We need to start telling our own story from our perspective, and that's what's going to drive it, the young kids of our future.
Well, I really believe that we are. I just think it's up to this community to tap into that and bring it here and watch it and support it and support those filmmakers and watch their material.
Well, Gary, thanks for coming to Omaha. We appreciate you. Maybe we'll have you again soon.
You're listening to a special program on Noon Forum. We've heard a panel discussion which followed a screening of the 2009 Canadian documentary film Real Engine, directed by Cree filmmaker Neil Diamond. The event was co-sponsored by the Native American Studies Program at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and by Native American Public Telecommunications Incorporated, presented in partnership with the 4th Biennial Visionmaker Film Festival, which took place the first week of October at the Mary Reapma Ross Media Arts Center and the Sheldon Art Museum in Lincoln, Nebraska. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, September 20th, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The event took place at Filmstreams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema. The members of the panel included Eduardo Zendejas, director of the Native American Studies Program at the University of Nebraska at Omaha, and actor Gary Farmer, born in Oswegan, Ontario, Canada, into the Cayuga Nation and Wolf Clan. In just a moment, the second half of today's program, we'll hear a discussion which followed a screening of the 2011 documentary film The Quilted Conscience, presented in collaboration with the Grace Abbott School of Social Work at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and the University of Nebraska Foundation. The discussion will be led by the film's director, John Sorensen. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 6, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and do not necessarily represent those of Filmstreams, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. The Quilted Conscience shows the beautiful and important story of a group of 16 Sudanese girls, refugees from the genocide in their country, who are thrust into a new life in the town of Grand Island, Nebraska. It's also the story of a quilters' guild of local women, some of whom have had little previous contact with ethnic or racial minorities, and of a quiltmaker who travels 1,000 miles to help stitch the two groups together by means of a culture blend fabric art project, the making of a beautiful wall-size mural composed of dozens of dramatic story panels made by the Sudanese girls with the help of the local women. Here now to introduce a discussion is John Sorensen.
Thank you very much. And I would like, before we go any farther, we have some of our stars here. Would you like to stand and let everybody see you? Okay. And I want to say a special, or now the lights come up, your identities are safe. But I also want to say a special thanks to a couple of the quilters and teachers, Tracy, and please just stand up for a second, and Kay Greminger, and Lynn Kronk is here someplace, is she not? hiding somewhere. There she is over there. And also, for those who are not with us today, because we're missing about six of the girls, I think, who weren't able to attend today, and obviously a number of the quilters, and maybe most of all Peggy Hartwell, who is in South Carolina. Actually, she's in New York right now. She's in New York today. So, questions. Anybody have any questions? And I would say broadly about the film itself, about the process of it, about... you know, how the teachers were working with the students. Since we have a few of them here, they might be able to help answer as well. Yes.
First of all, I just wanted to say I did truly enjoy your documentary.
Thank you.
And hats off to all the young ladies who were part of the film. I enjoyed you guys sharing your stories. I would just, I'm interested in finding out how exactly this program came about. It showed the woman coming from New York and her story and how she was a quilter. But exactly how was this type of program developed, or I guess what's the history behind it? And I thought it was unique in how this type of program could be beneficial to young people like themselves, like the girls that were a part of this film. And I'm just interested in finding out how it came about, because I've never heard of it before.
Well, I will say in one word, it's very mysterious, because it happened in a very roundabout way. As you notice with the thread going through it, and why our sponsorship here tonight is through Grace Abbott, who's a Nebraska woman who gave her life working for children and immigrants. I started a project almost 20 years ago honoring Grace Abbott, and initially I wanted to do a film about her. But one of the great glories of the system is I couldn't find the money to do it. And I was talking to a producer at NET, and she just said, find another way. Said, this woman was doing a lot of work for immigrants, children, women. All of these are issues that are very important today. Find something today, and then tease people a little bit, you know, go to the backstory. Well, as it happened, that was about 6 years ago. I had worked with Peggy in New York. I live in New York now. I was born and raised in Grand Island. But I was working with Peggy in New York on a world culture series. We did a Western Africa diaspora program. She is a founding member of a group called the Women of Color Quilters Network. It's a nationwide group. And she was in charge of coordinating and curating that exhibit. We just got to be very good friends. And weirdly enough, like a few weeks after the woman at NET made the suggestion that we look for a contemporary topic, Peggy called me one day because she knew about the project, and she said, if there's ever anything I could do to help... And I'm not the brightest guy in the world, but, you know, these two things seem to go together. And I started to, at that point, look at the community. I'm back in Nebraska quite a bit because my parents being here. And that's so 6 years ago was right around the time the Sudanese community was just starting to come to Grand Island. My background is all in narrative film and theater. And it was just looking for stories. And that new community coming in, I just found very interesting. I mean, I knew a little bit about Sudan and the history of the area, and that interested me. And because they were so fresh and new to this country and to this state, I thought there was something there. That was 6 years ago. It basically was a three-year process from then, talking with Peggy initially and figuring out what would the quilt be. The concept came up of the dreams and the memories, looking back and looking ahead. And it took 3 years from the time of that initial idea until we actually had the event, which was 3 years ago, most of what you're seeing there. Part of that was just financial. It just took that long to raise the money to be able to have a couple camera people here and so forth. But part of it was I felt very necessary. One thing that I really dislike about documentary film in so many cases is it's a bit dilettante. Like, people just do it without knowing anything about what they're covering. Those 3 years gave me a lot of time to try to meet the Sudanese community. Every time I came back here, every Sunday I'd go to the churches because it was the one place to meet people and try to just get a sense of the community, ask questions. In the meantime, at some point we contacted the Grand Island Public Schools. That was actually through Mrs. Kronk as well. And Tracy got involved looking for the students, as she says in the film, that she felt would benefit the most and would be able to blend in with it. So it was a very long evolution. I don't know that there was any point in the process where it was exactly clear what was going on, which was all the better, you know? I mean, yeah, she says that's true. We had many conversations where she's saying, I don't really understand what you're doing, but you seem to be doing it pretty well. So I just kept doing it. So I think it's a tribute to that. if I may continue with that, one of the unexpected byproducts, because I really wanted to just do a film that dealt with these immigration issues in Nebraska, children's issues, and so forth. The whole quilt idea was just serendipity and concocted. I mean, I just figured we'd make the film and that would be it. Well, Peggy went back to South Carolina, started telling people in the schools there, and they invited me to come down, and she and I did the project down in South Carolina. Simultaneously, Tracy, I think, had such a positive experience that she contacted Kay, and they've made it a permanent part of the Grand Island schools now. They call it the newcomer's quilt there. And in fact, they won the first prize blue ribbon in the state fair this year for the new quilt. Yes. Bravo. I'm going to be meeting on Tuesday with the Lincoln Public Schools people about bringing it to Lincoln, and my hope is eventually we'll have it to Omaha and other towns. I agree. I hope that wasn't more than you wanted to know. Okay. Someone else, yeah.
My question may have been answered, and I'm hoping a couple of the girls can be honest. I remember 40 years ago, or whatever it was, going into projects as a student and initially thinking, you know, this doesn't look like much fun. But then, whether it was art or something else, almost being transformed as I went through it, and by the time the project was ended, I had a much different feeling. Did any of you experience kind of a transformation as the project was going on, and would you mind sharing that?
I'm Nyakim, and I did experience a change, like, in myself personally, like, how I felt about, like, everything. Like, I used to think quilting wasn't, like, I don't know, like, fun or anything. Like, I used to thought it was, I don't know, boring, but... Like, I changed my attitude about it because I did, like, learn, like, just learning how to stitch, like, the simple thing of learning how to stitch. It, like, I don't know, it just changed, like, how I felt about learning new things and, like, just being open to, like, new ideas and, like, the whole project itself, like, it brought something good for everyone. Like, he got some friends and they got some friends and, well, you already have friends, but...
Not many.
But, yeah, it just brought new things to everyone, and people were able to accept it and go with it, and I was able to accept it and go with it, and everybody's here had a good time with it, yes? Yes? Okay. And you guys are over here just, I don't know, applauding us for this when, like, anybody could have done it. It's just the whole accepting and going with it and, like, just be willing to, like, share your memories, your dreams, just like being open to people, and that's what I've been able to do.
You know, in her saying that too, I suddenly remembered when we had two cameramen that came from New York to work on this, and I want to especially thank Bruce Stanbury and Sam Holt, who were shooting it, and Bruce also edited it. But when we had our first meetings talking about what the film was going to be, and I was describing it to them, the phrase I remember using is, to me, it was almost a kind of study in contrasts and connections. And I felt that's a lot of what's going on, is trying to make clear the contrasts between the worlds of the different people coming from different places, but obviously, too, it's so much about the bridges that are being made and the connections that are being made. And, I mean, it's been a personal pleasure for me, frankly, maybe even more in talking to the white ladies, you know, in the quilt makers that were working on the project, whom I see very regularly back in Grand Island, and what it's meant to them. I mean, the way that it's affected their lives, because I don't know outside of this that they would have had any contact with that community. And I think Kay articulates it very well in the film, and I certainly heard that expressed by a number of people, I think Lynn probably did too, of just the surprises for them. Which so much of that is just, it's life in general. I mean, we're only surprised because we got our eyes closed all the time. You know, we open them up and you freak out because you see everything that is there. But I think that's it was for me, on the other side of it too, from my side putting it together, that was a real surprise. And again, you kind of come back to the point I was trying to make earlier, which is just being willing to take those chances. Because frankly, a lot of this is just dumb luck. I mean, we had no lights. Our budget was so small, we had no lights. And it was Nebraska in September. We got 5 days of sunshine. And it looks brilliant. The lighting is excellent. But, you know, it ain't us. And had that not been, it would have been a bunch of mud. There would be no film. So, you know, a lot of that was just taking the chance that it was going to work out, and it did in this case. But, you know, viva for those who don't get the sunlight, because that's the process which is leading to the other good things. Another question?
So is there going to be an ongoing project?
Yeah, at present, I'm talking with the Lincoln Public Schools as the next stage with all of that. I mean, again, because we improvised so much of this going along, there was no written curriculum. And clearly, in trying to, you know, codify it, to make it something that can go from school to school, it needs to be put down. For instance, a lot of the guidelines that we figured out, when I went down to South Carolina to work with Peggy, because it happened very suddenly, and they desperately wanted to do it before the end of the school year, Peggy was the only real quilter we had. She had me. I couldn't even do a running stitch. I didn't even know what a running stitch was at that point. I learned very quickly. We had two or three other teachers from the school. Because Peggy is just so magnificent, it came out great down there too. But I remember the last day she turned to me and she said, "Never again. You don't do this with one quilter." I mean, so a lot of what Kay and I are discussing, and Peggy too, are what are the basics? You know, what are the minimums that you have to have in order to make that work? I think what I've found in trying to discuss with the LPS people, because I have to start figuring out what worked for us, and I think a lot of it it came down to very specific human beings. In our case, it happened to be Peggy and Tracy and Kay specifically. But that there was the kind of general guidance that Peggy was offering. She was floating from room to room. I mean, it was really Kay and the quilters that were, you know, hands-on with each of those groups of girls. Peggy was kind of inspiring and keeping tabs on everyone, and it made it fresh whenever she came into the room in that way. Tracy was indispensable in, I'm coming from my theater and film background, but I think the term is correct, in the casting. You know, in like finding the people that it was going to work with the best. And the same thing for Kay with the quilters. I don't know, but I've always felt there are probably like many people who might volunteer thinking it's a good idea, but you need somebody there to go, you know what, I don't think they're going to handle this well, or it's just not going to be a good fit. So that's a lot of those discoveries along the way, let alone all the technical things of just the fabric that is needed and the process of, you know, because even though the workshop was only those 5 days, the girls actually started getting together a good 2 months or more before that, just to meet each other, because I don't think a lot of you didn't even know each other, even though they were all in the school system, but in different schools. One other thing I will point out, and I think we've only got, well, we've got three of the girls here who are Nuba. They're different tribes as well, coming from South Sudan and from that area. Most of the girls were Nuer. We had, I guess, four Nuba, yeah, the both of you and your sister, and one Dinka girl, Yomaz. So, I mean, that also led to interesting combinations and so on. So there's just so many different aspects that come into play trying to figure out. I mean, also the question for me as we develop the project into Lincoln and Omaha, since there is also this newcomers program where it is mixed ethnicity, mixed national background, mixed gender. There are boys and girls and from all over the place. I mean, that produces very beautiful work too, but of a rather different kind. In the Lincoln schools, we're going to try to have two classes. One just for the Sudanese, which is also partly just to capitalize on having the film and the, you know, the goodwill that's going out from that, but also one that is like the newcomers class and see really which of them is working better. Should it just be one or another? Yes.
The quilt looks fabulous on the film, and I'm sure we're all really anxious to see it in person. My question is, how did you feel the first time you saw the quilt? I'd like to ask the girls that.
Somebody?
My name's Narika again. And when I saw the quilt, it was like, wow. Because when I started off, like, my quilt, I wanted to be a lawyer and a judge. And, like, I didn't have a face on it, so I thought it would look really bad. But after all, like, when you connect them all together, it's like a story. And, like, it just looks really beautiful.
I really like the quilt, like all the girls, like blocks coming together. It was really nice because the colors were like, they complemented each other, and it was just like pretty to the eye, I guess. And I just liked how all the other girls' ideas just like came together and like just made it like
awesome in itself. Like, I don't know what to say. I don't know how to explain it, like, in words. Like, that's just how...
Is it, what did you think it was going to look like? Did it surprise you when you saw it, or was it kind of what you had in mind?
Yeah, it surprised me. Like, I didn't even know that they were going to, like, put it all together. I thought they were just going to show them block by block, piece by piece, and, like, have the girls come and talk about it. Well, they did have us come and talk about it, but I didn't know they were going to put them all together, and I didn't know it was going to come out, like, really good. It came out awesome. Kudos to all the people that did it.
Okay. Oh.
I know you said that you did the groundwork that in the 3 years preceding, you went to the churches and you met,
yes,
families and you met people. But I'm wondering, what was the parents' reaction initially? Was anybody a little bit skeptical? And then what was the parents' reaction in the end?
All right. You know, to put it one way, is when I first started doing all of this, I learned one word in Nuer and one word in Nuba. I learned Malamagua. And I, more than one word, salam aleikum. I mean, just greetings, basic greetings. And I remember very clearly the first time that I went to each of the churches, the same thing happened. I stood up in front of the group, and I said, Malamagoa, and I'd get a standing ovation. And I think, you know, in the first place, they're surprised anybody like me would even know what the word was, but it also was a little tender to me because my suspicion is they'd never heard anybody from the white community say, make that effort, you know? So simple little things like that. I think they also, I was very visual with it. Peggy shared with me, she's got books with images of hers in it. I mean, she's very extraordinary quilt maker and artist. She has works in the Smithsonian and just phenomenal person. Showing her work also spoke beyond the words because there often were communication issues. I mean, lack of English, in the community, and I would have a translator, which also makes it very difficult communicating and even not being sure that the translator has fully understood. It certainly taught me to simplify and visualize, which again is also it's the point of a film. You know, you're trying to be as honest as possible but also still communicate in that way. One of the things that I found with some of the parents coming to the events, for instance, is I think it was... And I think that Tracy mentioned it when she was talking in the film, too. I think there was a little, I don't know, suspicion, but just confusion as to what in the world is going on and why are you doing this. And there were difficult moments, too. I mean, there were girls from families that one of the parents, as it started, got confused about it and didn't want them to participate because it didn't make sense to them. And that was another lesson for us, too, of just, you know, the communication that could be done before. Early on when we had those meetings with the girls to just let them know the general principles, the parents were also invited and extended family. We had lots of cookies, which worked miracles. Actually, that was one of the nice things when we were doing the project. As silly as it sounds, but it made a huge difference because we gave everybody cookie bags. I mean, like one of the women would make cookies, would bake them at home every day, and at the end of it, they'd all get their bags to take off home, and the brothers and sisters... I don't know if it's one of you, but I remember one of the girls coming up to me after the second or third day. And, of course, we partly chose the girls emphasizing Grace Abbott's heritage and so forth, but it also, there was a concern that the boys would not be interested. And after the second or third day, one of the girls came and she said, my brother wants to know when the boys get to do this. I think it was the cookies as much as anything else. But, I mean, again, they may seem trivial or silly things, but they help to build up the cumulative effect. To put it another way, too, because we have had many events together, and they've grown much less shy as the years have gone by, you know, when we have the public events and talking. One of the earlier ones was at the Hastings Museum, and a group of children from the Hastings schools in the ELL program attended. And I'd asked the teachers in advance, you know, tell the kids a little bit about Sudan, encourage them to have questions to ask, you know, thinking I'm going to get these, like, political questions or, you know, ethnographical questions or something or other. And, of course... The first question was, what's your favorite color? And the second question was, what do you like to eat? And part of me is despairing that I've taken the wrong path, but the ELL teacher came up to me afterwards and she said, God, those questions were great. And I said, why? And she said, don't you understand? They're not asking exactly what color, they're asking, are you like me? I like red too. You know, I like that food also. It was humanizing in some ways, and or just that connection, this sense that there was a commonality between, because most of those kids were Latin American background and so on. And I think you girls all got those letters that the kids wrote you, because after it, the children wrote, and it was just mind-blowing. These letters from children from Guatemala or whatever, just saying, my God, you're so beautiful, and I envy you so much, and I wish you were my sisters, one of them said. So, you know, it's how you put a value on all of that. Let's not, you know, it just is, to quantify it is a bad idea. It's just clearly that energy is there and it's allowing the opportunities for it. One more? Okay.
Thank you very much, girls, for taking us on this journey with you. I had a question. How many hours do you think you put into this whole film? Everybody and their work, is there any approximate hours? And how many hours did you do of filming?
We shot 80 hours. In order to get this hour, which is not atypical. I mean, they'll say you shoot an hour to get 1 minute in many films of this kind. But basically, from the day that the filming began until now, it is 3 years, 3 weeks, and so many days. I mean, just that is that slow process of so much of it was in the editing, and why Bruce, who was an editor at NBC for the Today Show for many years, for 25 years. Partly, I was just looking at his skills and relating to them. He was used to cutting short segments. And what we did initially were, and if you go to YouTube and put in Quilted Conscience, you'll see the early forms of all of this. We just made like 20 different little segments, almost like you'd see on the Today Show or something or other, and then began to lay them out, almost like the quilt blocks. And it was interesting to me how much our pattern followed it, that it was this pattern of all these blocks and where they fit together, and the extraordinary talent of Bruce is just knowing where those connections are and letting it flow. It becomes a river. In a way, for me too, because obviously, technically, this is a documentary. Since I have no idea what that is, since I've never really made one, and it doesn't even interest me in a certain way, for me, it's a poem. And for me, it's a poem that we made as a group. Because everybody's voice is a word in that poem, is a sound in it. And that is ultimately the editor is really the one that's finding all of those rhyming words and experiences and making them come together. But the short answer is a really long time. Okay. Well, I think that's it. Thank you.
We've heard a discussion which followed a screening of the 2011 documentary film, The Quilted Conscience. This event was presented in collaboration with the Grace Abbott School of Social Work at the University of Nebraska at Omaha and the University of Nebraska Foundation. The discussion was led by the film's director, John Sorensen. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, October 6, 2011, for broadcast at this time. The event took place at FilmStreams, Omaha's nonprofit cinema. On the first half of our Film Streams double feature, we heard a panel discussion which followed a special screening of the 2009 Canadian documentary film Real Engine, directed by Cree filmmaker Neil Diamond. These special screenings of Real Engine and The Quilted Conscience were part of Film Streams' community development program, which facilitates partnerships with other nonprofits and community groups on film-related events that speak to their missions and programming. Special thanks to Rachel Jacobson, Casey Logan, Maggie Wood, and Jim Foyt of Film Streams for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.